T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Score Rewind time, Sports Radio 670, The Score, Joe Ostrowski with you, and we'll start the Score Rewind hour with some White Sox conversation. The great Steve Stone is on the Score 3 times a week, and today he dropped by the Lawrence Holmes Show, and the guy started off by talking about Dane Dunning's outing last night.
I thought his performance was absolutely wonderful when you consider everything that he's gone through to get to this point. And, you know, I do a lot of tweeting these days because I think it's personally important to stay connected to the fans at a time when they can't get to the ballpark, see the games on their own. I don't want them to feel all that distance from a game that's been so much a part of their life for a long time. And they were all tweeting about how could you possibly send down Dunning for Delmonico? I mean, why make that move after the outing? Well, if the people were paying attention last night, if they did watch the game, they will remember the exact moment when I said his arm is losing something. He doesn't have right here what he had the first three innings. You could tell because that control that put the ball on the corners and threw it wherever he wanted to early suddenly started to desert him, and he is a guy with great control. But you could see it flatten out. I mean, look, I'm the product of a lot of years and a lot of games, and I pretty much recognize, actually with both pitchers, as a matter of fact, with Mize also, I recognized the moment when that stuff started to flatten out, when the arm lost the elasticity, when they started to labor a bit, and it's understanding with Dane Dunning. So the people that wonder why he's being sent down, we saw last night, quite frankly, the arm is not quite ready yet to pitch in rotation in major league games that are meaningful and to continue to have that kind of stuff. And what they want to do is, this is to protect him. This is to get him away from the pressure and the rigors and the stress and the strain of going in rotation every fifth day. They don't want that for him because he's too valuable looking forward. If he can harness, and I think he will, harness the stuff that he showed in the first three and a third innings, I think you've got yourself a rotation guy, probably middle of the rotation guy. That stuff will play anywhere. Same thing with Mize. He ran into the same thing. They both threw 4 1/3 innings. They both struck out 7. Dunning walked 1. Mize didn't walk anybody. One guy gave up one more hit than the other guy. So the performances were absolutely identical. But you can't equate the path that both of them took there. Mize didn't have Tommy John surgery. He hadn't laid off for I don't know how many months between actually pitching in a game that meant something and then going out to a major league start. So Mize is ahead physically, yet they both hit the wall at almost the same time. This is just the Sox way of taking a very valuable asset to this team and trying to protect Dane Dunning as much as possible.
How do you imagine that the White Sox are going to help bring along Dunning inside the season and also be able to help themselves? Like, how do you go about doing that with there not being a minor league for him to kind of stretch out?
Well, nobody can tell you exactly how he came out of the game yesterday. They might not even know right now. You might not know till tomorrow when he has a throw day on the sidelines. So if you can tell me definitively how he came out of this performance and how strong the arm is and how sharp that stuff is going to be, I could then give you a timetable. But the White Sox can't, and I can't. We don't know and won't know. And that's one of the reasons why they decided to get him out of the major league pressure and, you know, see what's going to happen moving forward. But so, you know, you do know, you could recognize in looking at his stuff that you've got the makings right now of a rotation that's going to be the envy of many next year. Let's assume Giolito comes back 100% of what he was last year. Let's assume that Dylan Cease, who is 4-1, by the way. I mean, the White Sox team is 3 games over .500, and Dylan Cease is 3 games over .500. He is the over .500 for the White Sox. This is still a young kid. He's 24 years old. I mean, this is a kid who has a chance to be really good and is off to a great start. So let's look at Giolito. Keuchel, who you know is going to come back and be what he is. He's just a keep-you-in-the-game, everyday guy who doesn't beat himself. Then you put in Cease. Then you bring back Kopech, who's going to be 100% when he comes back next year. And then you add Dunning to the mix with the possibility of Rodon, if he gets healthy. You've got yourself 6 different candidates for 5 spots, and you've got yourself a very solid and, just as importantly, a very young rotation. So to me, pitching is in great shape as far as the starters are concerned. And I think we've seen with the emergence of all of these arms out of the bullpen, these guys have a chance to be something special next year. They're much better this year than they were last, and they're going to be much better next year than they are this year. So for those who want the finished product this year, guess what? Not going to happen. It probably will happen somewhere in the middle of next season, depending on acquisitions, depending on going out and getting a free agent, depending on how the White Sox are going to scout their own organization. You've got to make a determination right now. As we're speaking, Lawrence, that determination is going on right now. You have to figure out who's going to be in your rearview mirror as a player and who's going to be a part of your future. If you see this guy in your rearview mirror, that's the guy you have to go out and make a trade and bring somebody in who's really going to help you. Then you look at the free agent market, and there's a lot of guys that are very valuable. I mean, people want Marcus Stroman. They think he would fit really well. To me, he's 4 games over .500. To me, you look at the other numbers and you say to yourself, well, you know, he's a pretty decent pitcher, but he's making $7.4 million, and next year as a free agent, he's going to want 15 for 5. He's going to want $75 million. Is that money better spent somewhere else if you got 6 candidates already for the rotation? My answer would be absolutely. I mean, Nomar Mazara is here on a 1-year deal, and Encarnacion here on a 1-year deal. You get yourself 1 or 2 left-hand difference makers, I mean consequential, run-producing left-hand hitters, and suddenly you've got tremendous balance in a lineup that's shown a whole lot of thunder right now.
I was really intrigued when you were talking about the idea last night on the broadcast on NBC Sports Chicago. I was actually watching outside on the My Teams app, by the way, Stoney. I figured out I got myself a drop screen.
Way to go, Lawrence. I tell you what, you're a tech wizard.
And I was watching it off of a projector. It was actually really cool last night. So I'm sitting out there and I'm listening to you talk about the idea of 2 pitching coaches. And I was like, that actually makes sense. So I wanted to give you a little bit of space to discuss why you think that's something that a forward-thinking team might pull off over the next couple of years.
Okay, so let's look at the current pitching coaches and what they have to be. A current pitching coach, to be effective, has to be 1/3 mechanic, 1/3 psychologist, and 1/3 father confessor. Hey, son, I know you're going through some tough times. Tell me what's going on in your life. I'm interested in you as the person, not just you as the pitcher. What can we do to smooth this out, to get you better so you can focus on the mound? Okay, well, that's good. But this game now, with the various added numbers and ways to quantify what a pitcher is doing, Rapsodo and the way to pitch the pitch, show you how much spin you're getting on each and every one of your pitches or lack thereof, that's becoming all-consuming to the average pitching coach who wants to work there. There's some wonderful pitching coaches. Don Cooper has been great for a long time, and I'm not telling you that he's not doing a good job. What I'm telling you is he could do a better job if you take away the psychologist and you take away the father confessor from his job description. Let one guy, not necessarily Don Cooper, I'm not talking specifics here. What I'm telling you is the forward-thinking team is going to say, I want one guy to be my mechanic. Something goes wrong, you go to a good mechanic, tunes your car up, he works with the carburetor, deals with the timing, does whatever he has to do, and suddenly your car's back on the road and it's purring. But unfortunately, we are not cars. We have five senses. We have a mind that governs what we do physically. And to get to that, you need somebody who is skilled. My preference would be a very aware former pitcher who understands the psychology of the game and understands how to maximize the psychology in knowing where you have to go to turn a light on. For instance, Sandy Koufax, who was the best or one of the best this game has ever seen, said he had his great stuff 25% of the time. He had to learn how to win with less than his best 75% of the game. This is a Hall of Famer. So if he only has his great stuff 25%, the 75% you have to maximize. How do you do that? You do that by a series of mental processings. You use imagery. You use creative visualization. You use all of the tricks. You try to use self-hypnosis. And I went to hypnotists when I was pitching, but I found that I didn't want to trust my subconscious with anybody else. The only person I trust my subconscious with was me. So I took the tenets of hypnosis, boiled them down, used them on myself, got together and figured out a way to get to my subconscious to reprogram exactly what I wanted to do. Think of your consciousness as a blackboard that everything you hear, everything said about you, every negative article, every coach that said you can't do it, and here's the reason why, is printed on the blackboard that is your subconscious. The job then is to reach in, erase the blackboard, and every day reaffirm that with positive affirmations. Write down that today you're going to be the best you've ever been. You're going to have the most energy you ever had. You're going to have your concentration rise commensurate with the amount of pressure in a game. You're not going to throw the same with two outs and nobody on as you will with runners at second and third and the game on the line. You want your concentration to increase exponentially. And how do I do that? You do that because it's explained to you by somebody who understands how to get it done. Most pitching coaches don't understand that. So having two guys, a division of labor, you take this side, I'm going to take this side, and we're going to take this guy and make him a better pitcher than he ever thought he was going to be. And the biggest factor is getting that guy to believe that you can make him into that with his help and the help of two guys who understand how to get there.
Yeah, I was fascinated by it. I'm glad that you were able to explain it a little further because it makes a lot of sense to me. Let's move over to the offensive side for a second. I feel like, and the statistics bear it out, if you look at Jose Abreu over the last seven games, two home runs, six RBIs, an on-base percentage of about 360, and he's slugging 560. When he clicks on, what is he doing well at the plate?
Well, first of all, people see that he swings his sliders in the dirt and curveballs in the dirt and fastballs out of the zone, and they say, oh, geez, boy, if he ever learned to lay off those. Well, guess what? If hitters always laid off those pitches, there would be no pitchers because you got to get them out some way, and that's a way to get them out. And Jose's going to go through periods where literally if the pitcher releases the baseball and it stays in the ballpark, Jose is going to swing. However, with the game on the line, he has a heightened sense of focus. He understands his job. He knows that he is paid to drive in big runs. And more times than not, he's going to find a way to get the job done because he understands his role. He knows that he's the man in the middle, the man tasked with driving in runs when the guys behind him don't. And that's what he's always done. You don't lead the league in runs batted in, which he did last year, without the ability to understand and rise to a situation. Jose just bears down a little bit more. The concentration gets a little bit better. You make a mistake when he's not swinging it well, he fouls it back. You make a mistake when he's really locked in and he hits it hard. And more times than not, it finds a hole, and sometimes it finds a place over the wall like he did last night when he took the game to 4-3, setting up Encarnacion to take it to 5-3 in another Sox win. So Jose is such a valuable member of this team. And when you understand that he wanted to come back so desperately that he told the White Sox, if you don't sign me, I'm going to sign myself. He took away every stitch of bargaining power he had because he could see what this team was going to be. And if he could see it, he paid his dues with some bad ball clubs. He wanted to be here as this team started their turnaround. And he could see last year, he could see the glimmers of hope. He could see the light at the end of the tunnel. He wanted to be a part of it. Consequently, here he is, a big part of it.
Stoney, I was talking with David Ross earlier this week about the Cardinals and the difficulty in scouting a team where you have so many people making their debut and it's kind of hodgepodge. So I'd love to know from your perspective, what's the hard part in dealing with a team? And this is a unique situation for both the White Sox and the Cubs over the last week where you kind of don't know most of who's on that roster.
Well, David's going to have and has had 5 games to figure it out. We played the Cardinals 3 games in 2 days. They had 7 players making their major league debut. But there is information on each and every one of these players. However, when you're dealing with pitchers you haven't seen before, it takes a while to take the video you might have on a guy and look at the scouting reports you have and then look at him from 60 feet, 6 inches and understand how to do it. That's why it's much easier to adjust to a starting pitcher who you might see a second and third time than it is to adjust to a reliever who you get one shot at. You don't know what his changeup looks like. I mean, that's you're seeing exactly what guys are encountering when they deal with Matt Foster. Matt Foster, a 20th round draft pick for the White Sox, has come in, set this league on its ear. Coming out of the bullpen, giving up nothing. His strikeout-to-walk ratio is laughable. It's in, knocking in the neighborhood of 9-1 strikeout-to-walks. It's everything over the plate. They haven't seen his straight change. They haven't seen the life on his fastball. They haven't seen his deception. And right now he's sneaking up on a lot of people. So the challenge for Matt Foster will be when they have seen him a couple of times. Now, what does he show them? How does he show it to them? And how does he make sure that they don't get used to what he has? The real good pitchers, they don't care. You could have had 50 at-bats or 100 at-bats against Greg Maddux. He still knows he's going to get you out. And the thing is, you know that he's going to get you out. When you get to that point, you go to the Hall of Fame as Greg did. Matt Foster is in the infancy stages of what should be a really nice career. What I like about him is he's not afraid of anything. He throws everything over the plate. But that's the difficulty in adjusting to guys you haven't seen. And when you're dealing with the Cardinals and all of their problems with COVID and all of the young guys and the injuries they've dealt with, you're going to see many more young guys you haven't seen. But the Cubs wound up taking 3 of 5, which is something you have to do with somebody in your division. So they adjusted pretty well. And, you know, you get the kind of starting pitching that they've gotten most of the time, you're going to battle teams and you're going to get there. The Cubs are going to be in the playoffs. I mean, they're just too good a team not to be. Chris Bryant hopefully will come back because he loves to see the stars stay in the game. But, you know, if he really, and I think, Lawrence, just for his own good, if he wanted to rest this entire weekend to make sure he was entirely healthy, I can't see anything wrong with that. I mean, you know, really gear it up until maybe the last week of the season where they rest him for the playoffs and the last 3 games he's a non-factor. But I don't think anybody would second-guess David Ross if they kept Chris Bryant out of these 3 this weekend just to make sure, and again, preventatively, just to make sure he's entirely healthy as they move forward.
Stone Pony with Lawrence Holmes today, Sports Radio 670. The Score. Stoney makes appearances on The Score 3 times per week. Just terrific every single time. Joe Osho, Sports Radio 670. The Score. Score Rewind Hour. How about on the north side as we're getting set for Cubs and White Sox? Let's hear from Ian Happ. Dude loves the 7th inning doubleheaders. I thought that was pretty intriguing. You're going to want to hear his conversation with Dan Bernstein next. This is 670 The Score and the Radio.com app.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
Strowski here bringing you Score Rewind. By the way, tomorrow night I'll be on the air from 6 to 6:15. Then our Cubs-White Sox pregame with Zach Zaidman starts. 6:15, they'll first pitch at 7:15, and taking a look, the odds are out. The White Sox are slight favorites, very slight favorites against the Cubs. Dallas Keuchel on the bump for the Southsiders. John Lester taking the hill for the Northsiders. And speaking of the Northsiders, let's go to this morning on the Dan Bernstein Show. Ian Happ made his weekly appearance, an enjoyable conversation. Take a listen.
It seems that even though the team, even though so many star players, guys like Baez, Contreras, Bryant, their production is being picked up by others in the lineup. So I can only imagine when this whole machine is fully online, it's going to be even more impressive.
Yeah, I think that everybody's doing their part. Everybody is putting together really good at bats, and you know the stat line might not show it for everyone, but that's That's why this team is so good, because we have great at bats so consistently. I think you can see it in the numbers of pitches seen. There's been some comments from opposing pitchers, just how much this lineup grinds, and that helps everybody. It doesn't matter who gets the hit, doesn't matter who gets the big hit, as long as we get it, as long as we're producing and winning baseball games, that's all that matters.
Yeah, it's also a reminder how games affect other games, because unlike other sports, baseball is played in serial fashion, where the effect of a long at bat or getting into somebody's pitch count in the first game of a series changes the way relievers are then deployed in the remainder of the series. And this was also part of the argument with Fernando Tatis Jr. and all the unwritten rules about, you know, do you swing on 3-0 and all that. As the discussion broadened, it was reminding people that every pitch affects other things in a way that you can make yourself more likely to win because of what you do, even if it is a blowout. So I think the Cubs have been, and everyone's been very effective at maximizing opportunities that way.
Yeah, it's huge, especially when you're playing a team like our last series, five games in 3 days. Even if you're losing a game big, just being able to make pitchers throw pitches, keeping games close to try to get to see the eighth and ninth inning guys. It's huge. It's little things like that. It's grinding out at bats, and it really does over the course of a series, over the course of a season. You know, if when a team leaves us, they're exhausted, you know, it's going to affect them in the next series they play. And it's just, there's a lot of little things like that that go into it.
Big story from last night was Craig Kimbrel notching a save, and it was also in the details. He touched 99 and then was sitting at 98, 97, seemed to have command of the curveball, wasn't wild in the strike zone, had that same higher release point. That would be a big deal if that reclamation project is on the right track.
Yeah, his last three outings have been really, really good. Looked super sharp last night, and just really awesome to see him blow at 97 to 99 by guys. That's really fun to watch. And what a great teammate. That guy's super easy to root for. Been super pro through every single minute since he became a Chicago Cub. I was with him in Iowa last year when he was first signed and starting to make his comeback, and just from day one, absolute pro and a great person. So you know, he's easy, very easy to root for.
I was saying when we started the show today, it's been a long time since I've experienced seven inning doubleheaders, going back to when I called games in A-ball for years in the Midwest League, and I love it. I'm all for seven-inning doubleheaders. I wouldn't mind seven-inning games for the 162. It just keeps things moving a little bit, and it, you know, dials up all the leverage, makes everything more important. I've got no problem with it.
Yeah, we had a pretty interesting series there where we went seven-inning doubleheader, I think 4.5-hour game for the nine-inning game, then another seven-inning doubleheader. So you can kind of see the difference between those days. But I love seven-inning doubleheaders. I was telling guys as I was walking around before the start of the series, said, guys, I know it's been a while for a lot of you since you played a seven-inning doubleheader. These are awesome. Like, they're wonderful. It's a huge game changer. If we ever play a nine-inning doubleheader again, I don't know what we're doing. Seven innings is exciting. It limits the amount of time guys are on their feet. It lets the starters play both games for the most part. It keeps away from hurting anybody in the bullpen. I'm all in on it. I love it. And I think that it's something that should continue.
I was fascinated by the interview with Anthony Iaposi just because of what it revealed when it's just baseball players and a coach talking about hitting. And it's one of my favorite things about baseball, and always has been, no matter what level I'm covering, whether it was being, you know, in and around in the minor leagues and around the cage and in at those little back areas of the hitting net, and watching hitting coaches when the roving instructor used to come through, just eating up all this stuff. How much of this is psychological? and how much is headspace and how much is approach and confidence and presence and awareness, that the technical stuff at this level, so many of you handle on your own. You're your own hitting instructors when it comes to your hands and your how your front foot lands and when you load and all that. But where Anthony Iaposi seems to be kind of next level on some of this is in how he talks to you and how he gets you ready to do your work and ready to hit. And that just makes the major league level of it different.
Yeah. Everybody, you know, you're the only one that can feel your body, right? As the hitter, you're the only one that truly knows how you feel, how comfortable you are in the box, and what you're trying to do. So you can be coached the mechanics all you want. You can try to tweak things, but if when you get in the box to compete at the highest level, you don't feel right, already done. You're already not getting a hit. So I think the most impressive thing about Post, the thing that I've learned so much from him and love him as a hitting coach is he is just so focused on the mental, on making you feel right. Doesn't ever talk mechanics unless you ask for it. And I think that part of the equation is just so, so important. And he really gets it. He really gets how what could be happening at home or what could be happening outside of the batter's box, the psychology of not playing every day or being in and out of the lineup or having uncertainty, how that affects the hitter and how that affects the baseball player. Because every one of these hitters, they're humans. And to be a great hitting coach, you have to understand the human element before anything else. And he's so, so good at that. And I just wanted to get him on the podcast to kind of shed a little bit of light, because I think he's such a good influence for a generation of coaches and for young hitters and for people that can listen and say, I don't need to have the absolute perfect swing, or my mechanics, I don't have to grind on my mechanics every single day. The mental aspect, the thinking, the understanding of how you're going to get pitched, of how you should feel in the box, that's way more important.
And especially with all the data at our disposal right now, of everything that the Rapsodo device is measuring, of everything we know with how fast the bat is moving through the zone, how long the barrel is in the zone. It's a matter of getting through all that and making it matter that I found interesting. And he talked about his time in Texas, too. It's like, how do you tell, Chinsu Chu, who is from a completely different culture and was and evolved as a hitter in a different way that maybe you can never understand. How do you tell Adrian Beltre with 3,000 hits when he comes to you and says, I need help? It's like, well, what am I going to tell you? You got 3,000 hits. It's being able to interpret everything for each individual guy. And that's a big lift.
Yeah, and everybody has a story. Everybody grew up playing on some different field. And Post has this really cool thing that he started a couple years ago when he first got here, and it's called Where It Started. And he would take guys on like Google Maps or Google Yep. Earth, and you would have to show where you first started, where you fell in love with the game. And like his was his street where he grew up in New York. And so everybody has a story, and you hear countless, if a hitter is really good at going opposite field, like they'll talk about how they grew up and the field they played on growing up had a really short porch to the opposite field. And so they grew up just flipping balls over that fence because that was the easiest way to hit a home run. And now they get to the big league level and they're great at going the opposite field. But why would you ever want to change that? And that's something that it's you hear more and more stories like that. And trying to put a hitter into a box when they've spent the last 10 years or 15 years hitting one way, it's silly. It makes no sense. And that's something that I learned a lot from him too, is just everybody has a story. There's a lot of reasons why hitters are the way they are, and to try to change that, especially at the highest level, doesn't make any sense.
I think the Cubs are actually using some of that stuff about where it started. I saw something on Twitter, and there was something also on the Marquee Network on the broadcast where people are actually showing it, and they're asking fans to mention it too and to point out wherever they grew up, whether it was in the farmland somewhere, like you say. I think Post is from Astoria near Queens, where I just thought that was really cool because I can picture it in my head right now. I mean, it was suburban driveway ball, and as we got older, the home run line would go further across the street to the point where you actually had to hit it over the house across the street when we got bigger. We couldn't use a tennis ball anymore because we were breaking windows. But yeah, that's real for everybody. That's their baseball world.
Yeah, it's really cool too. And when you kind of go back and look at it, and like for me, going back to look at my high school field on Google Earth and just kind of seeing like we didn't have a right field fence until my senior year, maybe, and it ended up being like a portable fence. So the only way I could hit home runs was we had a short porch to the left, and it was to pull balls right-handed or to try to go opposite field left-handed. And it just, that kind of is how my swing developed. And that's where I fell in love with the game. And back when I was playing, it was all dirt infield. And the saying was that if you hadn't the field was called Wildcat. And if you hadn't given some blood to Wildcat, then you hadn't worked hard enough because it was all dirt. And there was bad hops everywhere. So you'd be taking ground balls and you'd get one off the chest or one off the nose. And if you hadn't bled on the field yet, you hadn't worked hard enough.
You mentioned something too, that was, it's a corollary to a famous line that I've always heard about parenting. You said, if you're a big league hitting coach, you're miserable every night because there's always at least one pupil who's struggling. And it reminds me of the best advice that I ever got about parenting, and that is you're only as happy as your least happy kid. And it couldn't be more true. And Post pushed back a little bit. Like, he doesn't look at it that way, that he's able to find some positives in there. But I totally get what you're saying, that no matter how well somebody's going, your mind is always going to go back to the person that you're responsible for who's struggling a little bit.
And yes. And I don't think the hitting coach is ever being called into the manager's office or being called from the front office and being like, hey, man, those guys that are really raking, great job. They're really going. That's all you. And it's probably, the question is probably like, hey, the couple guys that aren't hitting, like, what's going on? Like, what are you trying? What are you doing? I'm sure that that's just part of the job. And that's part of the job that I don't envy. And when guys are going bad and you're trying to figure it out, like I said, the hitter is the only guy that knows how he feels. And as a hitting coach from the outside, you can't jump in the box with them. You can't, you don't want to overload them with a bunch of thoughts and make everything worse. And you have these hitters at the highest level. You have guys that are the best in the world. And so you just have to trust those guys and let them go and understand that it's just a matter of time. And I think that pounding that thought process in of you're the best hitter in the world, you are here for a reason, it's just, this isn't going to last. It's just a matter of time. I think that's what the best hitting coaches do. And we've been really fortunate to have a couple in Chicago that were really good at that.
Talking with Ian Happ, as we do every Thursday on Sports Radio 670 The Score. When a teammate is struggling, I know it depends on the personality. And obviously, Javier Baez and Chris Bryant and Wilson Contreras are very different people. What's the proper way to approach somebody? What distance? I don't even mean social distance at this point, but are there some teammates where you feel compelled to reach out and say, hey, you know, you're good, don't worry, everything's going to be fine? Or are there guys where you know, stay away, don't say anything, that you're only going to make it worse?
I mean, I've played with a lot of, you know, different personalities throughout my career. And yeah, you always have to know how guys handle failure and what guys want a pat on the ass and what guys want you to stay away from them. But I think since being in Chicago, one of the amazing things about this culture is that you're always picking your teammates up. You know, we're always trying to lift each other up. We're always trying to make each other feel comfortable and feel valued. And we've been doing that for a long time. And I think even since I got here in 17, LaStella was a big part of that when he was here. Tim Buss was a big part of that when he was here. Anthony Rizzo is obviously a huge part of that. And it's just being able to have genuine, honest conversations with each other, whether it's in a one-on-one or a group setting. And just kind of, for years, we've voiced opinions with each other saying, hey, it's okay to talk to each other about how you're feeling in the box. Even if you're, like, if you're absolutely miserable, it's better to say that than hold it in. Because it's really difficult to go through a tough stretch. I've been through plenty in my young career. It's very difficult. It's a lonely feeling. You feel like you're letting the team down, and you need your teammates to tell you, hey, that's not how, like, we're not thinking about your tough stretch. We're thinking about winning baseball games, and you're helping us every single day. And that's a very important distinction. And it's something that we've done really a really good job of here. And I think that's why no matter what or who is going through a tough stretch, we're still winning baseball games, because at the end of the day, that's our number one focus.
What has Jason Kipnis meant to this team this year?
A lot. Great teammate, really awesome veteran presence, a guy with no ego that has come in and been just a really good addition, really fit well in the clubhouse. Clutch at bats, and I think just the quality of at bats that he puts on, whether it's off the bench or in a starting role, have been very, very impressive. And I think Jason Kipnis has had a wonderful big league career, and it's not even close to over. So for a guy with that amount of experience and the winning pedigree and the ability to understand the game, we were very lucky to get him, and I think he's been just an absolute stud of an addition to our team.
Ian Happ on the Dan Bernstein Show every week, and that was Ian earlier today. Sports Radio 670, The Score. The Cubs and Sox series kicks off tomorrow night right here on these airwaves. John Lester on the mound for the Cubs, Dallas Keuchel for the White Sox. Coming up next, Score Rewind, Sports Radio 670. The Score. We'll hear from Go Cats, head coach of Northwestern. What's going on with Big Ten football? Is there a chance? It doesn't sound great, but Fitz is a little optimistic about what might happen in the winter. We'll hear from him next. 670 The Score on the Radio.com app.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
Third quarter just closed in the NBA playoffs between the Lakers and Blazers. As odd as that sounds, I think it's the most intriguing series, or it's about to close. A couple free throws here to go. The Lakers way ahead of Portland in this one. Third quarter is almost done, and it's 88-56. Earlier today, Bucks took out the Magic, 111-96, so that series is tied at 1. Rockets over the Thunder, 111-98, even though OKC led much of that game, so Houston takes a 2-0 series advantage there. And the Heat go up 2-0 on the Pacers, winning 109-100. Joe Ostrowski with you, Sports Radio 670. The Score. Want to thank my guests this evening. Cody Westerlund dropped by, and so did Chris Altruda. If you missed those conversations, I suggest you check them out. Podcasts available, 670thescore.com. I'll tweet out direct links at Joe0670. Want to thank my producer, Jordan Malley. I'll be here tomorrow at 6 o'clock with a truncated version of Early Odds, and then the full one-hour version on Saturday morning, 8 to 9 a.m., Sports Radio 670 The Score. I leave you with Pat Fitzgerald on the Mully and Haw Show talking about what is next for the Big Ten. Good night.
Were you happy with the schemes?
Next question.
Coach, you hold.
Don't come here once every 2 years and ask those questions. I don't want to hear that from you.
I can ask the question.
Good. That's ask. I'm not answering it. Oh, don't come here once every 2 years. Coach, I don't want to hear that from you.
Break.
Yeah. Sure, I see you to show up.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.